Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 7 of the Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in East Nashville, Tennessee. I'm so glad you've chosen to join me once again as we take some deep dives with a cast of wonderful musicians, producers, and engineers that I've managed to track down and speak to about making music, records, and just doing what they do in their lives in music. Don't forget, there's a link to a playlist on Spotify and Apple Music with links to many of the songs we discuss on today's episode. You'll find links to those playlists in the show notes below or at our website. Meanwhile, the show continues to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription, which is a monthly payment of your choice. And when you sign up for Patreon, you get an ad-free version of the show to listen to, as well as getting entered to win a cunning prize pack from our sponsors at the end of the season. Or if you're tight for dough and you still want to help out, you can subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just by spreading the word, sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, a huge thanks to the sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know I sent you. They are Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra 1964, The Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resophonic Guitars, and The Hen House Hang. All right, thanks so much to you for tuning in, and let's get down to it. Howdy, music nerds, and welcome back to the show. This is episode number 144, and my guest today is the phenomenal songwriter and a veteran of the LA music scene, Mr. Peter Case. Oh, yeah. Thanks for tuning in today, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy this episode and conversation. It's been a nutty week here in Nashville with some major storms moving through and scaring the bejesus out of this East Nashville neighborhood, which survived the latest tornado, which was in 2020. Man, there's nothing like seeing those crazy dark clouds move in quickly and suck the daylight away before the storm hits. It's pretty nutty. We've had 3 or 4 days in a row like that here, but we're still standing. Other than that, I'm finishing up some mixing here on a couple cool projects and getting ready to play the Vancouver Folk Fest. I'm doing that with my own band, and then I'm backing up Joe Henry, I'm backing up Joaquin Cooter, and then a really cool multi-artist show that'll feature a bunch of Grateful Dead songs performed by folks like Amethyst Kia, Ruth Moody, Maya DeVitri, and lots more. And I'm sort of running the house band for that. That should be a riot, and I'm looking forward to that one. Maybe see some of you out there. I know there's some Vancouver listeners, so come say howdy. I'd just like to shout out to a new donor this week who is generous enough to help support the show. So my thanks go out to David Monahan. Thanks, man. So on the show this week, we have Peter Case, who I've been aware of for a long time. He's been making records for decades and has some really cool stories under his belt. And he's also a bit of a guitar nerd. So it's fun to get into that with him as well, because I'm a guitar nerd as well. Peter has a brand new album out called Dr. Moan, and it's available now at all the places that you get the music from. You know where those places are. So Peter is originally from Buffalo, but moved to the Bay Area as a youngster, and that's where he started getting into the punk scene there with a band he started called The Nerves. The Nerves moved off to LA shortly after, and that's where he started to flourish as a performer and songwriter. And after they broke up, he formed the Plimsolls, which were more of a straight up kind of a roots rock band, I guess more in the rock end of things than the roots end of things, but definitely from that same scene as like the Blasters and X and Los Lobos came out of. They signed to Geffen and made some killer records, which you should check out. Their hit or their signature song or whatever was called A Million Miles Away, and it was pretty big for them, and they started touring all over the country. So the Plimsolls kind of broke up as well, and Peter Case started a solo career and worked with some amazing producers like T-Bone Burnett and Mitchell Froome, both guys before they were the uber producers they are today. He's worked with tons of killer players on his records too, like David Hidalgo, Greg Lee, Scurf Morlicks, Van Dyke Parks, Ry Cooder, Benmont Tench, Mike Campbell. His debut album was nominated for a Grammy Award and led to a string of other cool records, like The Man with the Blue Postmodern Fragmented Neo-Traditionalist Guitar. Yep, that's an album title, and it's a damn cool album. Six Pack of Love is another one. Let Us Now Praise Sleepy John, that's a more recent one. And Full Service No Waiting, that's one of my faves. There's something like 15 solo albums, I think, and the new one, Dr. Moan, is exceptionally cool too. It features mostly songs written and performed on the piano, which is kind of a departure for him in some ways and not in others, because he's always played keys, apparently, which I didn't really realize, because he's really known as more of a guitar-wielding artist. So he's still out there crossing the country, and you can keep track of all his music, all these releases, and all his tour dates. Go see him play. Go buy some of his music. You can find all that at petercase.com. So let's get down to it. Please enjoy my conversation with Peter Case.
I want to get another J45. I've had a couple of them. I gave one away, and I don't know, man. But I would like to get a nice one. You know, but I played one of those, you know, those ones they were making around in the 90s were pretty good, you know.
They were, and they're making some good ones again now, too.
There are was they sort really? Of a, How
yeah,
much are they?
I'm not really sure. I haven't looked at the latest sort of pricing. They're not cheap. Gibson's, all that Gibson shit is pretty pricey, but they, you know, they're making some of those historic reissues where they're like using, you know, the proper glue and like all that
really?
Stuff. Yeah. And they look and they sound.
You know, I'm really interested in that. There's a real, you know, I was always a Gibson player.
Yeah.
You know, I got my J45 new for $750 or something like that from Fred Wallachy. And it was a great guitar, but I gave it to my son. And
has he still got it?
I think so. Yeah. I think he has it hanging on his wall.
Yeah.
I also gave him a Hummingbird at one point, so neither of those guitars are in my hands anymore. They were great guitars, but there's a difference in feel between Martins and Gibsons, you know.
Oh yeah.
And there's something about I love my Martin, you know. I've been playing Martin for, you know, 25 years now after getting out of the Gibsons, but like there's a precision in a Martin and a great beauty for it. I got a D28, you know, and it's very nice.
Mm-hmm.
But the bass on it, and there's something about the mix of a J45, man. It's really, really
That's what
cool.
I like about it. You know,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
instant record sounding.
Yeah,
me,
yeah,
usually.
Yeah. It's kind of a tough sound, you know. It's, I mean, Martins are too. They're a very beautiful sound, but
they are.
There's really something about the way, I don't know, just the thunk of it. You know, it's very nice, Martin Gibson. So I'm thinking of doing it. I've got a couple Gibsons. I got one of those 00, you know, whatever it is, the small. I got one a 50s, one of those, and those are very nice. And then I've got an L1 that.
Oh, I like those.
A vintage remake of an L1. It was nice. It yeah. is nice. Yeah, I played around the house, but I don't take it on the road.
How come? Just not a roadworthy.
It's just not versatile enough to do all the different things I like to do with it
yeah.
with the Martin. So I take the Martin and a Taylor 12 on the road.
Oh, you got a 12 on the road too. I've got a Taylor 12. I don't usually
so you
like
which one you got.
I got the Leo Kottke model.
I'll tell you, man. You know, I was friends with David Lindley a little bit, and you know, late great guy. He was just like the greatest guy in the world. But I ran into him outside of McCabe's one day, a guitar store in West Los Angeles, you know, in Santa Monica.
Yep, I know it.
And I'm coming down the street there. And he's coming out, you know, and he just goes, "I just played the best guitar I've ever played in my life." I go, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, I can't decide whether I want to buy it or not. I've got enough money in my pocket to buy it, but I'm supposed to go to Las Vegas to be in a shooting contest, a pistol contest. So I can't decide because I got to go to Vegas and I can't like just spend all my money on it, but I really want to." I said, "Which one is it?" He goes, "Leo Kottke 12 string."
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
went, so he didn't buy it. He went to Vegas and shot his pistols. And I went in there and I didn't have any money at all, but I went in there and I bought, this is an amazing guitar, man. The Leo Kottke 12.
Oh, so you've got one too.
No, I don't. I have a 355.
Oh, okay.
So I got a 355 a really long time ago. It's another McCabe story. I went to McCabe's to see John Hammond Jr.
I know John well.
Do you really?
Do.
How is he these days? Is he okay?
Yeah, he's pretty good. He's, I mean, he's essentially retired, you know, like he's not really going out anymore.
You should tell him Peter Case sends his love and his best, you know.
I
love John Hammond Jr. He was always a great guy to run into on the road.
Yeah,
he was just the greatest guy, but and a great musician. But I went and saw him play one time at McCabe's, and he pulled a guitar off the wall. You know, they have a million guitars there. And he pulled this 12-string off the wall and played blues on this 12-string, and it was a maple 12-string. And I just thought, that's incredible. It was so beautiful what he was playing on it and everything. The 12 blues in a 12 string is a really special thing.
Yeah.
And I had the money. I wanted to buy it, but he bought it instead.
He did?
He just bought it right off the wall. And that was it, man. And so I talked to Taylor and they made me one exactly like that one.
Oh, wow. Cool.
The very end of the 80s. And I've still got it. You know, it's been my road guitar. I call it the Canon because it's like this really intense guitar.
That's what I call my the Leo Kaki model.
You do?
Yeah. I call it the
Canon.
That's
interesting.
Because it's, well, it's designed to be a step and a half low. So yeah. It just sounds, you know, you tune it to a C sharp and it just sounds crazy massive.
I tune mine two steps low.
Okay.
Mine's down to C.
Yeah.
I wonder why they do C sharp. I wonder if that's better than C. I wonder if that would work for me. I don't tune it. I tune it into a, yeah, I tune it down to C. That's right. C, standard arrangement, but C. And Lead Belly went down to B. Yeah. You know?
Did he really?
That's what I hear.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, yeah, I guess he did. You can hear it. But the C sharp, that 12 string, but the Leo Kaki is great. So yeah, I started calling it the Canon. Somebody called it a Canon at one of my gigs. And,
and it stuck. Name, that's funny, man. That's exactly what I call mine. I guess it's cool for me because like the way that it's designed, like it's actually designed and set up to be played a step and a half low. It's not just like, I don't just do it. It was actually designed that way. And so it's intonated for that. And the scale is appropriate for that. And you know, if you play a G chord, it's an E chord, so that's kind of convenient.
That's right. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
that's interesting. You know, I've had my neck reset and everything, so it's pretty much set up for playing low.
Yeah.
Do you buy a stock set?
No, I think what I do is I use a heavy set and then I have a bunch of singles that I augment.
I do the exact
with.
Same thing. Yeah.
There
yeah.
is John Pierce, they have a set designed for the C-sharp tuning of the 12 string.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I started using a 70-gauge bass string because yeah. I also thought that was something Lead Belly did.
Now I'm curious. I'm going to look and see what I have on mine. I have it written down right here.
I put a 70 on there. It's kind of too heavy, but it's insane. And then you use like a 32 for the high string. That's crazy. Or if you put it, because if you use like a real thin like silver string on the, you know, just a regular, you know, not... It's too skinny and you can't fret yeah. both of them. You know, it doesn't work, you know. For a while, I was just obsessed with getting like a big, fat, you know, super fat sound. I'm kind of like less in that area now.
Yeah. They're not easy to play sometimes. But that thing, the Taylor stays in tune really well, which is cool.
A lot of that's cool. Things, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I don't really like Taylors usually, but for whatever reason, that Kottke 12 just totally.
They make the best 12s, I think.
I don't know. I guess there's just not as many out there. And the ones that are out there, they don't seem to like put, to me, they don't seem to put as much care into the 12s. And so they end up being a little like the tuning can be funky or the general playability of the, like a, you know, a Gibson or something when you can find
a 12. I find that too. Yeah.
It's just a little weird, but the
it's
Taylor.
Not as good.
Yeah. The Taylor
Martin
seems to be,
yeah.
You know, you need playability with a 12 string or else it's a gong show, as you know.
Lindley had a great guitar. It was a Goodall. And
oh, yeah.
And so I ran into him later. I did a gig with him, you know, I don't know how much later it was. It was a little bit later after that. And he goes, okay, well, you like that Kaki? Check out this Goodall, man.
So
and the Goodall
one.
Was made with Hawaiian wood. And it was just a beautiful, great. Maybe that's maybe the best guitar I've ever played with. David's Lindley's Goodall. It was just a great 12 string.
Did you have much experience with Lindley, like in the studio or anything over the years?
He came and played with me on the blue guitar, Man with the Blue Postmodern.
Oh, is he on that guitar. One?
Yeah, he came out for that one. He played on Put Down the Gun, and he played on a song called Hidden Love. He played Electric Bouzouki on Put Down the Gun, and then I can't – he played – David Hidalgo played fiddle on that, and then
wow, that's David, a great lineup, man.
David played – I guess he played it's a long time ago and I haven't listened to it for a while, but he just played guitar on it. And, yeah. And, he was a great guy. You know, I was kind of scared when I was, you know, I was a lot younger than, you know, he comes in David Lindley, oh God, you know, and then he came in and he was like really fun to hang around with. And then I ran into him at various places on the road. So, I ran into him once in Canada when he was with El Rio X.
Yeah.
And then we became sort of friends. And then I played some solo gigs with him, a number of solo gigs. He was on the road with Wally a lot, who was his drummer. And I would run into them in very strange places out in the middle of the United States.
He did a lot of gigs, a lot of small gigs, man, in crazy places.
He did. Yeah. I remember coming out of a hotel like in Omaha or something one time. I didn't even know he was around, but he's pulling up in the parking lot. And he's in a pickup truck with a camper shell on the back with Wally, and they've got all their equipment in the back. And they were up there doing gigs too, man. Yeah. So it was cool. So I played a number of shows with him. The last time I saw him was before the pandemic. We had a really fun time. We played in a place called Harlow's in Sacramento. And we just hung out all night in the dressing room, and it was really fun. So, you know, I mean, he was just a wonderful guy, really great, great player, very wise.
Yeah, guy. He was a big influence on me for sure. And
yeah,
he was on this podcast that we're doing now in 2019, I guess. And at that point, his health was starting to go a little off the rails, and he was really struggling with his hearing, and it was really frustrating him. Like, I think he pretty much packed in the thought of playing live at that point, because it was just, he was in pain if he was, you know, playing at a stage level. So he just felt like he couldn't do it anymore. I think with COVID that sort of was what ended up.
Why was he having trouble with his ears, Steve? Was it because of tinnitus?
Yeah, it was like extreme tinnitus that was like painful to him.
He had it really bad for a while, and it seems to have,
yeah, I think it came and went, and then eventually it got to the point where it just like stopped going away. I don't know the details, but that was what I sort of inferred from what he was saying about it.
And I was playing with bands all the time, and we used to be really loud. It was
El Rey OX was pretty damn loud.
They were a real thing.
Yeah, yeah. Were they kicking around the LA scene like locally when you lived there? Because I know you sort of went there in the 70s, and was that like, was Lindley a guy that was visible around town at that point?
Not so much in where I was, you know. I was kind of on the rock and roll scene, and he was with Jackson, I think, then.
Right.
We kind of crossed paths with the Jackson camp starting around 83.
Yeah, it seems like it wouldn't be that far away from what your world was, although it was slightly different. And
not
in the 70s,
far away, yeah.
You were sort of more in the punk rock end of things, I guess. But
yeah, things were real separate for a while. And then there started to be some more interplay. Starting around 83, we became friends with Greg Ladani, who as well, he was producing the Plimsolls, but he was also producing Jackson.
Oh, right.
And so he was like mixing our record, and then he would take it over to Jackson, and he'd come back from these comments from those guys.
Really?
It was pretty funny. But and we were sort of disdainful at first, but I love all those guys. And then Jackson took me on the road in 86 for my first solo record.
Yeah.
I went out as the opening act with Jackson. I played solo. He had his full band, and David wasn't in it at that point. He was doing El Rey OX at that point.
Yeah.
But Jackson was super great and like very helpful too.
So all that guitar talk leads me to ask about your new record, which really has pretty much no guitar on it at all. And I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
One guitar song, yeah. The first song on side two is a guitar song.
Yeah, and you know, like most people know you as a guy that's, you know, carrying around a couple axes and doing your thing that way, and going back through the Plimsolls and all your early bands and the Nerves and stuff, it was always guitar based. And then this record is pretty much exclusively piano based, which is super cool. And
that's right.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, if that was like a new thing for you, or if you've always been a piano player, or if this was like a kind of
I've always been a piano player, man. When I first joined bands in like 1970, I wrote songs on the piano. In fact, there's one on this record I did called The Midnight Broadcast, which I'm really proud of. This record was on a very small label, but it's a cool record. And I played piano on that, and I played his first song I ever wrote on the piano is on that record. It's the first song on the album. But I played a whirly back then in full-on like six-piece, five-piece rock and roll groups.
Oh, you did?
And
okay.
When I left Buffalo, though, I had to leave everything behind. And I just took the guitar. And from then, I would play piano anytime I got a chance. I mean, piano, you know, like I'd be at somebody's house. Get him off the piano. He won't get off the piano. I love playing piano, and I didn't have one. So somewhere during the Plimsolls, you know, I played B3 on the first Plimsolls record, clavinet. And
oh, you did, eh? Okay.
Yeah, I did. And when you hear it on there, that's me. And I'm trying to think the first album of mine that I played piano on. Well, it took me a while to get around. I guess Six Pack of Love, I played some piano. But and so there was a lot of piano on that record. But I just love playing piano. It's such a kick, you know. To me, it's like all about songs, you know, and singing. Yeah. And so, like, I don't feel like I'm really, like, it's still a Peter Case album, and it's still exactly what I do, but it just Peter Case, the piano album. And it's like got the same kind of musical influences, except it's on the piano a lot of it. I love playing piano, and I had an opportunity to be around one a lot over the pandemic. And so I just started playing the piano every day, just boom, 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 okay. The songs, learning songs by other people, you know, just playing piano and fooling around every day, you know, as much as I could. Uh-huh. I played at a church for a while before the pandemic.
Okay.
And then it was a St. John Coltrane Church.
John Coltrane?
Yeah.
Oh.
Orthodox, African Orthodox Church.
Wow.
The Church of St. John Coltrane, it was called. And I played there every week for a few years, but that was big because I played with a group, you know, a couple hours every week live with this church was really cool. But then I'm home and I'm just playing stuff and I'm learning and trying to, you know, I play kind of a gut bucket jazz, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not really like, you know, I learned a little classical music as a kid, you know, when I was 14, I was playing Rachmaninoff and I played Moonlight Sonata and I played Chopin's Prelude and C minor.
Oh yeah. you had some shit going on.
I got it going on really quick because I just took lessons for a very short time and a guy threw me into the deep end and told me to swim. He'd stand over there with a ruler. It was kind of a joke, but he hit me with a ruler. And I still have the sheet music. He would write like skull and crossbones and all this stuff on it. And so I didn't, but then I left home again. I left home really young. And so I did one concert with playing piano, playing Rachmaninoff. And then I hitchhiked to New York, you know.
So Buffalo is where you were born and that's where you grew up and started playing music.
Yeah. My big sister played piano. That was a big influence.
When you were still in Buffalo, were you playing in bands or anything like that? Or was it not really that point? Oh, you were? Okay.
No. I started playing in bands when I played my first gig when I was about 14, I think.
Yeah.
And I always played in bands. I had bands with like really stupid names though, because it was the 60s and I was just a kid. So I had a band. We had names like Mustache Sandwich was one of my bands.
That's a good 60s.
That's a terrible name, isn't it?
I like it actually.
You know, we printed up cards in shop class. You ever have to do that? Like you had to do a project for shop. You had to take shop in my school. So we're in the shop class and you could print up calling cards. So I printed up Day Glow Orange Mustache Sandwich calling cards. And they were spelled, it was like an old English Mustache Sandwich, you know, weddings, parties, anything. And it had my dad's phone number on it at work.
Nice.
So that you could call, you know.
During the school day, they could reach you.
I got the strangest call today at work, but it's when we told my mother, you know, something about mustache or something. I don't know. It seemed like a wrong number. So we never got any calls through him. But then, so that band played like at the Elks Lodge and the youth center and the fire department. They'd pull out, they had a, you know, those kind of gigs. And then we had a band called Pig Nation.
Nice.
And Pig Nation actually was more together and got a bunch of followers. And this was 69 and then in the 70. And then I got my first review in Pig Nation. It was an angry denunciation by the local newspaper.
Really? They weren't fans.
They weren't fans. So I was playing keyboard in all those bands.
Gerf Morlix grew up in Buffalo too, right? Did you guys know each other?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
I was from this neighborhood called Central, and I can't remember what his neighborhood was called. My football team, we had Sandlot football. We were the Central Raiders.
Yeah.
And I was 10 or 11, and we rode our bicycles across town, challenged them to a game on the next Saturday, and then practiced all week. And then we went back the next Saturday, and we played Gerf's team.
Oh, yeah.
On Saturday. And we had this guy on our team, and his name was Jimmy, but everybody called him Cannonball. And like every play, we just gave the ball and he had his like dad's football equipment. It was like one of those leather football helmets with no face mask.
Yeah.
And, he had the whole football uniform of Bronco Nagurski, you know, kind of look. You know who I'm talking about, what it looked like. And we would just send him up the middle on every play. And Gerf still remembers Cannonball. It was horrible to be in a game with Cannonball. I was a lineman. So like Cannonball would come running right up your back, you know. And he just stomped me, and then he'd go right over me and then stomp Gerf, you know. And so it's really fun.
So you guys go way back then.
We go way back. So he's older than me, and like I kind of looked up to him. He was like a guy in the first band I ever saw playing live in my life was Gerf.
Wow.
Can't play in the, and they had, he had a great band even back then, and he was probably about 14 or 15 or something. And they were killer. And they were my favorite group, and I would go see them play. And I actually, the first time I ever sang in public was with Gerf's band. Gerf let me sing a song. He Gerf left the stage, and I sang a song with the guitar, bass, and drums that were up there. And then on the break, you know, yeah, we go way back. And so I looked up to him, and he used to call. He was a lot older than me, you know. Like at that time, the age difference was really huge. And yeah. I remember my mom calling upstairs. Like I was super into blues and all this stuff when I was a kid. And my mom's like, Peter, Gerf's here. And and so Gerf would come in like, Gerf's here. Wow. It's like getting a visit from like, you know, the boss or something. So here comes Gerf, and he goes, I hear you have B.B. King live at the Regal. had a special order. I had the only copy in town. He really wanted to hear it, so I loaned it to him. So that's how we became friends.
Did you ever get it back?
I think so, probably. But I can't remember. I had B.B. King live at the Regal and the Best of Muddy Waters on Chess.
Yeah, man. Great records. At this point in the show, I'd like to thank our amazing sponsors for the season. We couldn't do it without their support, and this year they are Mule Resophonics. Swing wider for inspiration with Mule Resophonic guitars. These are Resophonic guitars built for acoustic guitar players. Not just blues guitars, not just slide guitars. You don't need to play them in open tunings. They're set up with normal acoustic guitar action, and they have some of the best feeling necks in the game. Trust me, they're wicked. These musical tools wake up your ear and influence your playing towards uncharted musical realms. Check out the current lineup of guitars at the Mule Store at muleresophonic.com. Thanks to Deering. Deering Banjos make some of the finest instruments out there these days and caters to all levels as well. If you're just getting into the banjo, they offer their incredible Good Time series, which are high-quality instruments at lower prices. Deering Banjos are all made in the USA, and their website also features some incredible info on their products and just general banjo information. And now Deering is also making Pro Pick finger picks and thumb picks, and that's exciting because I've been using those finger picks for years. They make these cool ones with the fingertips missing, and I love those. They're the best. You can get info on the banjos and the finger picks over at DeeringBanjos.com. Union Tube and Transistor. Union is known for guitar effects pedals with a focus on quality and simplicity. They build durable, repairable products that sound amazing both on stage and in the studio. Their fuzz effects and compression pedals are insanely cool. I use the Sonebender Fuzz, the Moore pedal, the Lab, and the Swindle Overdrive all the time in sessions and live on stage. You can find out more about them at uniontone.com. And finally, the Henhouse Hang is a 3-day immersive recording experience at the Henhouse Studio in East Nashville with me, Steve Dawson. It'll be in September 2023 and then upcoming again in September of 2024. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll show you the ropes of recording roots in Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Hen House Hang. All right then, let's get back to the show. You mentioned that you were into blues and stuff. Like, were you collecting... Like, did you have guys like Mississippi John Hurt and Reverend Gary Davis and Sleepy John Estes have all sort of cropped up throughout your career in various ways? Like, were you collecting stuff, and was it easy to get your hands on that kind of music in Buffalo in those days?
No, it wasn't. Two things. Like, the local record store, there's this woman there, and she was like an old lady, you know, and I'd go and hang out in the store when I was like 13, and she was an old lady, and I think, I look back now, she was probably about 32 or something, you know? and so I'd go in there, man, and she was really cool. She had, like, a beehive, kind of, like, big hairdo, and she would be standing there chain smoking and looking out across the parking lot and talking about blues and jazz, you know, which was she was really into. And I got into – I hung out with her a lot, you know, and she turned me on, you know, so the B.B. King and Muddy Waters and Mississippi John. You couldn't find those records very easily back then. And so I wanted to – my sister came back from college at one point with a copy of Sing Out. I think it was 1966.
The magazine.
And so I had a copy of Sing Out that had Mississippi John Hurt in it. You know, anything about Lightnin' Hopkins. And like Jack Elliott. I think the Fugs were in there too.
Nice.
And I learned a song by the Fugs, Kill for Peace. And I played that with all my teenage garage bands. Mississippi John Hurt, I had to go down to the local library, and they had a whole rack of records over there. They had two things for me that were like super useful. It was so exciting. Like, you're unraveling the mysteries of music as a kid back then. It's different now. And I think that you have to do the same thing, but it's like kind of the opposite. Now you have like a million things and you have to work through the million things to get to the good things. Back then there was like nothing.
Right.
You know, if you go to the library rack, it's like Victory at Sea by Percy, you know, Faith, you know, like just the records, you know, then you come to this one Today by Mississippi John Hurt. And I go, I think I want, this is the one I want, you know? And so I took that home and I loved it. Mississippi John Hurt. Before that, I listened to Josh White a little bit. I didn't understand as much, but I liked him. But then when I got to John Hurt, it's like, wow, this is fantastic. I mean, Josh White's fantastic too. Another record they had there was, they had a History of the Blues at one point that was pretty interesting.
Who was on that?
Also, maybe a little later. They had that book, man. It's like a big book by Lomax, Folk Songs of North America.
Okay.
By John Lomax, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a big, thick tome. I've got it here. I've had it for years and years. And I had that, and I would open it up and like get songs out of there, you know. So I learned one song out of there. I learned a song that Leadbelly did out of there. I learned it out of the book first, and when I was a cowboy out on the Western Plains.
Love that song.
I had my garage band, you know, the Sandwich. You know, I go over there and I tell those guys, you know, we're going to play this, and we're going to play it like Doug Somm would play it, because it's like cowboy out on the Western Plain, like Texas. So let's play it like a Doug Somm. So we go into like a Tex-Mex thing, and when I was a cowboy. So everybody thought we were nuts, you know, but that's what we were doing. I got that out of that book. Years later, I was with T-Bone down in Texas, and we were talking about it, and I go, yeah, you know, got this book, and all. He goes, yeah, Jeffrey Lee Pierce, this guy from the Gun Club, gave me this thing he called The Book, and it was called The History of Blues by Paul Oliver, and it was The History of the Blues. It was a red book. He gave it to me eventually. I've got it around here somewhere. I think I'm looking at it right now, maybe, he would take lyrics out of old blues songs and use it, and he goes, whenever we got stuck, I wrote some songs with him at one point, and we're like, he goes, get the book. So I was joking, you know. So I was joking with T-Bone about it. And T-Bone goes, well, Bob, you know, Dylan, he has a thing he calls The Book. I go, really? He goes, yeah, it's the Folk Songs of North America by the Lomax.
Okay.
And I go, and wow, I've been reading that since I was 14, you know.
Wow.
And there were two books I would always read at the library, Folk Songs of North America. Like, I would just pore over it. I can't remember if it was why I didn't take it home. I think it was a reference book. It was really heavy. I would just read it at the library. And it's like a little town library, you know. And then they had this huge book called Being in Nothingness by Jean-Paul Sartre. And it just seemed so absurd to me that there was a book that was so fat about being in nothingness. And like the first half of the book was being, and the second act was nothingness. And I didn't understand. And I would open it up and laugh because he couldn't understand like one word he was saying in the book. You know?
But you kept going back to it.
I would read it for laughs. I would show it to people I was hanging out with. And then, but the folk song book, you know, I was really into that. So I was playing folk song gigs and rock and roll band gigs at the same time. So I would go play at the Fire Hall with the Sandwich or the Pig Nation or something. And then I would go play the Unitarian Church Basement.
Like a coffee house thing.
Yeah, do a copy. I was sharing a dressing room once with Dave Van Ronk, and we were talking about early gigs. And I go, yeah, you know, I think I started my folk song thing at the Unitarian Church. Unitarian Church, he says. You know, I would have starved to death years ago if it wasn't for the Unitarians. He goes, you know what happens when you move to a Unitarian neighborhood, don't you? They burn a question mark on your front lawn. You know, really funny guy. But, you know, I was raised as a Unitarian.
Okay.
And my parent, in other words, I was raised like with completely befuddled and questioned everything about in the world. And but they gave me the key to the church and in this little town, because I could go in there and play piano. And so I would play the church piano. And I wrote that song, Just Hanging On. It's the first song on Midnight Broadcast. I wrote it in a church. So I'm recording Midnight Broadcast, which we recorded at a church in Martha's Vineyard called the Old Wailing Church. And It's got an incredible echo in it. It's like an old, it's like the church in Moby Dick or something. Yeah. It's like old Wailing Church. It's the real old Wailing Church. And we recorded the album in their midnight broadcast on a Nagra tape recorder. It's like a two-track, you know, the record's cut. It's a combination of two-track and ambient music that we also recorded, used Moogs on.
Wow,
and so
cool.
An interesting record, a combination of folk music and, like, you know, Brian Eno or something.
Yeah.
But when we got in there and I played the piano, and all of a sudden I go, wow, it sounds exactly like the church where I wrote this song. And I said, I just played that song and they recorded it. And we opened the record with it.
Wow, that's so cool.
Midnight Broadcast, available somewhere, somehow. You know, Midnight Broadcast, I'm really proud of it. It came out during the pandemic, though. It's my first of two records that I got out in the pandemic. And we did it right before the pandemic hit. It's on a little label called Bandaloop, but you can get it. You can probably get it through any of the big places. But, you know, I think it's one of my best records.
I like that record. It's cool.
Oh, good. Yeah. Because it's supposed to create, it's like the idea, like you're driving late at night on an abandoned highway out in the middle of nowhere in a car, and it's dark, pitch dark. You can't see anything. And, oh, God, you got a long way to go. It's nighttime driving. And you turn on the radio, and all of a sudden, like through the static, this like incredible song starts up, and then it's like all going in and out of phase, and there's a DJ playing you, like, and music sounds so much different in a situation like that. It kind of goes straight to your heart. And so that was the idea of that album, was like, it's the we even have a DJ on the record, right?
Yeah, yeah. Was that a thing for you, like when you were doing the new record, was it partly some sort of connection to your early days of like playing the piano in the church and like trying to recreate that sound in your head that was hitting you there? Like, were you sort of going for that kind of thing at all to reconnect or anything like that? Or,
you know, it's a good question, because there is a thing when I play piano that I used to have that it would be like, I don't know how to describe it really. It's like, we're getting to the good part, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When I was a little kid, you know, I used to they'd make me go to bed. Did you ever have to go to bed when the sun was still up?
Sure.
Like, it might, yeah, like when you're little, right? Like, they make you go to bed and it's like still sunny out.
I'm from Canada, so it was still sunny till 10 o'clock sometimes.
Where are you from in Canada?
Vancouver.
Okay. So it's not that much farther north than Buffalo, I don't think.
But... No, not really.
So I guess it would be sunny out. Yeah, and I'd be lying there in bed. And so I would start going, duh. I'd be like rocking back and forth in bed and going, duh, 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 duh. And to me, I was like making up a symphony, you know? And I'd be like, my dad would come in, you know, quiet down in here. You know, go to sleep. Told you, quiet down. No, you got to settle down, go to sleep. You know, and so, but then I was thinking, I got to do it just one more time, because, like, I was just getting to the good part.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally I'd be like, boom, boom, boom. You know, I would have this whole thing going, you go, quiet down, you know. You know, but to me, that was like a lot like playing the piano. It was like, that was when I was really little. And then later on, like, I wouldn't really know exactly what I was doing, but you would get to these parts that were like really, like, oh, this is the good part, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I did notice that, you know, I used to always do that as a piano player. It's kind of because it wasn't my main instrument either. It was exciting to do it like that. And then for a while that went away for me on piano, and I just didn't play piano for a long time. I just wasn't having that experience anymore. I couldn't really tell you why. And then somehow it started back. I got it back, you know. And so now, like, that's kind of what this album is in a way. It's like, you know, all of a sudden I'm back to, like, the excitement of, like, music, you know, that, like, really turns you on, you know, to make. And so that's what it is, you know. You go with the things that – a lot of the best things, you don't know exactly what – you know, it's going beyond really what you know. I heard somebody say one time that art is – you know, art is always something you don't know how to do. Like, it's the thing you don't know how to do
that.
You know what I mean? And so you don't really know how it's going to turn out when you start writing a song. Everybody knows that. You start writing the song and, like, it just could go anywhere and you don't know. And that's the great thing about writing songs, is that you start with nothing. And at the end of, like, the songwriting session, you may have, like, this thing. It's this thing. And you play it for somebody. Oh, the song.
And it didn't exist.
But it just came out. Yeah.
Was the process of writing for you different on the piano than it was, like, you've been sort of a guitar focused artist for so long? When you started sitting down again at the piano and, like, reconnecting with that instrument, did the music come to you writing wise in a different way than it had been before? Or was it just kind of the same thing and it happened to be the instrument that was sitting around?
It's always different when I write. It's always the same and it's always different. And so the way it's the same is words don't come first necessarily, or music doesn't come first. Sometimes they all come at once. Sometimes they don't come. Sometimes you get the words and you just write the words down. And I'll have words and I write words. And sometimes I'll just make up music and then I got to set the words to music. Mm-hmm. Or set words to the music. And it comes all different ways. And I don't have any really one way of doing it. I do it different every record. It's the same too. One thing I do is, and the thing that's the same about it is I try to get it to this place where I feel like it's, we're there, you know? And it's like, there's this thing that tells me that it's finished. So when things are still moving around all in flux in it, I don't feel like it's finished. And also I have this thing that I do, you know, when I was a kid, I wrote songs. And so I had this song, like I would write songs and nobody liked my songs. And then all of a sudden I wrote this one song, that Just Hanging On song I'm talking about. Yeah. And I played that and like older people, like they were like old people, like 23 years old or something like that. They would go, hey, that Case, play that song again. You know, we'd be around a piano. Case, play your song. You know? Uh-huh. And they tried to like that song. And so I went home. And I'm like, I got to write another song, man. These people, that I look up to, they really like it. I'm going to, you know, and I make up another song. And I play it for this guy. I go, hey, man, check out my new song. I go, yeah, sure. I play the song for him. He goes, Case, you know that's bullshit. Don't. And so that kind of jolted me, man, because I guess I did know it was bullshit, but I just wanted to see what the market would bear, you know? And so it wouldn't bear that, you know?
It's good, good to test the parameters.
Yeah, I tested the parameters. And so it gave me, I don't know if it's the best thing because it's kind of hard on myself sometimes, but I have a way of like, when you're a songwriter, you have to get off your back to write stuff. But at some point you got to go, how would I feel if I just walked into it and I didn't know myself and I just heard this?
Right.
There are enough here for people to get into it, to be able to like understand where I'm coming from and who and how and what. And you get, you know, that's painful actually to the other part of you that just like making up stuff and getting to the good part. Yeah. And so that's that. Yeah. So the process was the same. It was different. It was exciting though. It was very different. You know, I don't always write with an instrument. Sometimes it just comes in your head and then you try to get it down on an instrument. Mm-hmm. And then other times like the instruments, the playing that you're doing comes out of a song that you already know. It can go all different ways. But the important thing for me would be to, you know, find something that really, you know, got my interest. You know, that's the thing really. I'm looking for that thing. I'm looking for the question that I don't really know the answer to. Uh-huh. And then, you know, I write so I know what I think is another thing. It's like I write a lot on paper and stuff, you know, because I'm not really that articulate. In history, I haven't been unless I write too. I have to be able to, I don't really know what I think about things sometimes until I write about them. Uh-huh. It's a weird thing.
Yeah.
My dad, when I was little, my dad used to go, well, you know, this was ridiculous. What's going on with this report card or something like that, you know? And what do you have to say for yourself? And you know, I never had anything to say for myself with my dad, you know.
I want to rock.
I want to rock. I'm going to drop out of school at 16 and head for California. No, I didn't tell him that. But, you know, I just want to rock, Dad. Get with it, man.
Yeah, man.
I didn't have anything to say like that. I used to sit there in school, though, and you'd look out the window, man, and see the cars going by. And it's like, oh, God, you know, I got to get out of the school, man. They're killing me over here. There's a whole world. I mean, I'd read Kerouac when I was 14, too, you know.
You were ready to go.
Got to get out there, man.
Yeah.
So I did.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Made this record, it seems to be like a really interesting production decision of the overall project, that it was going to be really piano forward, because the music, you're right, like it does sound just like a Peter Case record, but it's noticeably like the featured thing is the piano. So was that something that you set out to do? Like some of the songs, they could have gone in a totally different way if they had some guitars on them. You know, they could be like really straight up kind of roots rockers, that kind of thing. And there's some really cool ballads and stuff like that. But the way that they're presented with the piano, and a lot of them are just like very sparse and like, you know, pretty much just the piano, although there's other instruments in there sometimes. But how conscious of a decision was that to approach this recording that way?
At some point it was conscious. Like a little ways in, you know, I've got like, oh, this is it, you know, where this is going to be a piano record. I wanted to focus it. I like things that are focused, you know. So, I mean, I wanted to, you know, instead of just being all, I've made records that are all over the map, like my first solo record or especially that one. But I'm trying to remember if I've done other ones like that, you know, where you have like all different kinds of like band lineups and solo lineups and all kinds of different things. But what I wanted was to have I had this feeling that was going on that did kind of echo what was going on with the shutdown. Mm-hmm. Created kind of a refocusing of our lives.
Yeah.
And that was definitely part of it. And so like, I felt that it would, that it was a good idea, that it was a fresh thing to do, was very interesting. So, you know, I loved it, you know. To me, it's not that different. Some people are like, oh, you know, you should just play to your strengths or whatever. But I kind of feel it is my strength, songwriting and singing. And so like, if I'm singing with a piano, like remember Nilsson sings Newman, you know.
Love that record.
I mean, Nilsson never done that before that, and then we got that record. Like, this is like the greatest record, Randy Newman on piano and Nilsson. That's the whole record. Yeah. It was one of my favorite Nilsson albums.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just incredible. So that's kind of the thinking about it. I've always loved when Bob Dylan played piano, you know, on Black Crow Blues or Spanish is the Loving Tongue, you know, those kind of things. And so, or Monk's solo records, you know. So, I mean, Monk's such a giant, so you can't really compare it. But you know, so I thought it would be different and fresh and like something new to, you know, Peter Case, the piano album. It's not like a radical right turn musically like I did after I left the Plimsolls and made my first solo record 100 years ago. That threw people for a loop. But I don't think this will, because it's still the same kind of songwriting, and it carries you along with the voice. And then the piano, you know, the piano is kind of like a drum. There's a great bass player on the record named Johnny Flowers. And John Flowers is like he's just a great all around powerful electric and acoustic bass player. And so he's kind of like the drummer in a way. And then the piano is very drum like too at times. You know, I'm a rhythm piano player. I can't really do, you know, the chest thing, you know, that guys do. So it's all pretty much orchestrated rhythm and grooving rhythm, you know?
Yeah.
I like music that grooves, that has a feeling, like gives you a body feeling, even if it's a slow song, it gives you a way to tap your foot, or like a way to like, you feel the groove, you know, it makes you move your shoulders or whatever, you know, they say, but you know, and I like that a lot. And that's, so we're trying to go between the guitar, the piano and the bass. I feel like there's a whole, you know, percussive section, you know?
Yeah.
And so I guess that answers the question. It was pretty, once we got to the production level, I knew that we were going for that.
Okay. And where'd you do it? Like the piano is really, really unique sounding. Like is it an upright or is it a grand or what is it?
I looked around the city for a piano and I found one up in Nevada with this guy, Ryan McCaffrey. He had a studio up there. It's called Sun Machine. And I'd heard about it from another piano player and I went up and tried it out. He's got a 1905 Steinway upright.
Oh, okay.
Completely restored.
Wow.
And it's in this big, big room, you know, and that's what we did the record on. So,
cool.
Okay. Yeah, it just was you know, he had it restored. He'd found it somewhere and it was beat up and he had it fixed. And,
wow. That's a huge undertaking for a piano, an old piano like that.
Yeah. He put a lot into it and it was just a great piano, and it's still a great piano. You can see it, and there's a video of how, have you ever been in trouble now up on YouTube?
Okay.
I'm do the video. You can see the piano on there. I mean, not that that's it just looks like an upright piano, but it's a great piano.
So did you do the whole record in one time period, or was it sort of picked away at like during COVID, or how did you do it? How did you actually track it?
We tracked the majority of it all in one time period, yeah. In very early, in the early part of the year. I kind of mixed up about what year and what happened. I think it was last year.
Me too. I think everybody is.
So we did almost all of it at one point right in there.
Okay.
And then we mixed it. There was a little bit that went down. The first two songs that went down were done actually in 21. At the very end of 21, I went into the studio one day and I did Ancient Sunrise. And then I did all those guitars on Wandering Days.
Okay.
I did the whole track of Wandering Days. And then Johnny played bass on it. And we did all that. That was the first day of recording those two songs.
Oh, cool.
And then, you know, we had to break over the holiday or something. And then we came back and finished it. Yeah. And so I did like another 9 or 10 songs, and then we put it together, you know, okay. Or 8 songs or something.
You mentioned a few times your first solo record, which I think was it like 86 or 87 or something like that?
86, yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about that? So T-Bone produced it, but also wasn't Mitchell Froom involved in that record?
Yeah, he was, because T-Bone produced most of the record, and then he had some dates on the road with Elvis Costello. And so the two of them went off to like, you know, France or something. I don't know what they were doing. And
I just saw Elvis last night.
You did?
Yeah.
How's he doing?
It's doing good.
Doing great. Well, he and T blasted off, so Mitchell finished that record. But I started it with T-Bone in 85 down in Fort Worth.
Oh, Eagle Audi. He's from there, right?
Yeah, he is. And so I lived with him down there. We had an apartment down there. I was living there with him for a while in 85, early 85, January 85. And then we went into Eagle Audio.
So
we were sharing an apartment in the back room and the front room. And we were just hanging out in there. And I would write every day when I got up. I don't know what the hell he was doing. Probably, I think he was studying the life of Lyndon Johnson at that point. But
what was his deal at that point? Like he hadn't become the uber producer yet. Like he hadn't had the huge pop success that he had.
He
like
just
in the,
about to.
Yeah, just about to. And but he'd already done the Dylan stuff. Like who was he to you at that point?
He was a guy I thought could help me. And so I realized that he was a singer-songwriter that kind of came with a lot of rock and roll background. And he was about the only one I could think of.
Okay.
He was producing a few things. I met him at a Los Lobos set. I met him twice. Well, at Million Miles Away was a big hit in the West Coast. And one time I was at a gig and T-Bone comes up to me in a crowd of people and he goes, "Who produced A Million Miles Away?" I go, "Jeff Eyrick." He goes, "Thanks." So the next thing I hear is like T-Bone's hired Jeff Eyrick to produce his new album.
That's a Plimsoll song, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was weird. And I don't know how that worked out, but next time I saw him, I went down. I was with this guy, Kid Ramos, and me. We were hanging out. And we were learning Lightning Hopkins songs and hanging out. And me and Kid went down to see Los Lobos at Studios. I forget what it's called. Not Sunset Sound, but the other one. Sound Factory. We went in there. You know, this is like 85, I guess, or 84.
So they're just doing like their second record maybe or something.
Yeah, they were doing their second, or maybe their first. They were mixing their first record.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, after the EP, they were doing "Well, the World Survive," and it was 84. Yeah.
Okay.
And we go in there, and I met T-Bone in there. You know, we just had a really goofy conversation. He was like saying some insane shit. I can't remember what it was. Something about Marilyn Monroe and John Wayne and John Lennon and Yoko Ono or something. It was like a really far out.
But how did you stumble into a Los Lobos session? Like, how does that even happen?
Well, they were friends of ours.
Oh, okay.
They were the, we played a lot of gigs with the Plimsolls and Los Lobos.
Okay.
I can't remember really. We played a lot of gigs. You know, I knew Caesar and David, I guess, the best. But they used to play a shoot. We play on the road. They used to open for the Plimsolls way back in the
really?
Million years ago.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
So, believe it or not. And so any old how. So I was writing these songs and the Plimsolls really weren't going to play them. And I was starting to realize that I was going in a whole other direction. I was going back to what I was doing before I joined the Nerves.
Yeah.
I was in rock bands for about 11 years, but I kind of threw over everything to be a bass player in a rock band. I hadn't really ever been a band player like that in a band, you know, for years. And so I got into learning how to write 2-minute songs and be in the Nerves, 1975. And so I was going full circle and coming back into it in 85. Like, I was writing, doing kind of what I was doing beforehand, was like playing solo and acoustic and playing blues and roots influence music. And, you know, everything was just kind of happening. And I knew I needed help. And the Plimsolls were floundering. And we were kind of like past, we'd taken like a few big shots and it wasn't really working. You know, we'd had a big hit, but then when we had a big hit as an indie. And then when we went with Geffen, it was like really mishandled probably. And the whole thing exploded. And I ended up,
as it does,
as they do. And as I ended up saying to this woman, I love this woman, Carol Childs over at Geffen, just like a great person. And I said, Carol, I need help. I want to work with this guy, T-Bone Burnett. It just came to me one night that I thought that was the thing I should do.
Okay.
So she set it up, you know, and I went out to meet him, and I got there like 3 hours late because I drove in the wrong direction on San Vicente Boulevard. There's this one street in LA, and me and my wife have a joke that if you're on San Vicente, you're lost.
Okay.
It's like cuts through town at the weirdest angle, and it goes, I can't even figure where it goes, you know? And so I drove, instead of driving out to where he lived, I drove out to like, you know, the other, I got incredibly lost. And I finally, I showed up like 3 hours late to his place. And he goes, are you always this late? I go, no, I'm not, you know? He goes, okay, what can I do for you? And so we ended up, I went down to Texas with him. We set up this record, and I would get up every day in this apartment, write songs, playing for him at night when he came back. I don't know what he was doing. He had his own business going on. And I wrote all that stuff, like there's like songs like Small Town Spree and Ice Water. You know, a lot of the songs were written in that pad. And then we went down to Eagle Audio. It's like a studio, and we produced demos down at Eagle Audio to make the record. And
that's in San Antonio.
No, it's in Fort Worth. I was there in Fort Worth for quite a while. Then we came back to LA, and then we went into Ocean Way and Sunset Sound and finished the record with a great band, you know, including Roger McGuinn, Van Dyke Parks.
Awesome.
Jerry Marotta on drums, Keltner on drums sometimes. Packett plays guitar at one point. Froom came. And then, so we did all that stuff. And then the record company got mad at me. T-Bone went on.
What label were you on at this point?
Geffen.
Oh, so they signed you as a solo artist too?
They signed me as a solo. And then they were excited about it. But then when the people higher up heard it, they got somebody, this big, it's a long story, but this big manager, I don't even want to go into the story, but there's some guy like was talking dirt about me, like I was going in the wrong direction, you know?
Okay.
So they suspended my record. They suspended us, me and T-Bone and everybody. It was all put on ice. And so it was all over.
Wow.
In the middle of 85, we were almost had finished the record, and then they froze it. T-Bone split. I was just sitting there, and now I'm out of, you know, there's no band. I'm playing solo gigs around town, like for $50. And it was a really weird period. And then months later, I get a phone call and they go, Peter, we'd like you to come in and take a meeting with Tom Zutaut. He's the new head of A&R here at Geffen. I go, really? And I go in to meet with Zutaut. He'd just come to Geffen. He's the guy that like discovered Motley Crue.
Okay.
And so he's like a superstar. And then I think he signed Guns N' Roses, you know. He's like a big guy, you know. And he but he goes, Peter, they gave me all the records they're working on right now. When I came over here, they gave me everything they had here at Geffen. Somebody else confirmed this for me too. And he says, I thought all of it was like completely, you know, a waste of time, except for one record. This record you're working on with T-Bone. I think it's fantastic. And I want to finish the record.
Wow.
So we went into the studio because of Tom Zutaut, and we finished the record.
And those are the sessions that Mitchell Froom produced?
That finished the record. There were just a couple songs. The ones he produced, he remade one of the songs we did at Eagle Audio, which was Steel Strings.
Okay. So who was Mitchell Froom at that point? Like I know of him, of course, for his great production work. But at that time, was he just a keyboard player around town or something?
Yeah, and he'd done a little bit of production, but he hadn't even done Crowded House yet.
Yeah.
He was very unknown. I'll tell you a funny story, man. So I'm like, yeah, I want this guy Mitchell Froom to finish the record because T-Bone's going away. We can finish it with Mitchell. And they're like, oh, I don't know, Peter. Mitchell Froom. Who's this guy Mitchell? I go, look, trust me, this guy's great. He knows exactly what he's doing. I can't remember, you know, So, okay, we'll let you work with Mitchell. So we finished the record with Mitchell. 3 years later, I'm working on another record over at Geffen. And they go, Peter, we've got someone we really want you to meet. He's a great producer. He's had a number one record recently. And he's interested in working with you. His name's Mitchell Froom.
You're like, yeah, old news,
go,
man.
I introduced you to Mitchell Froom 3-4 years ago.
Yeah.
So anyhow, so Mitchell came in and finished it. You know, it was an exciting record to make, man. The most important, exciting part of the record was Van Dyke Parks, who was a hero of mine ever since, like, you know, Nilsson Sings Newman. We were just talking about when I was a kid, you know, he wrote that song Vine Street. It was so beautiful on that record, you know. And
I love Van Dyke.
He did that version of it that I knew. He didn't write it. Randy wrote it, but he had done a great version of it on Song Cycle. And I loved Van Dyke Park's Song Cycle when I was a kid. Yeah, yeah, you did too?
I love that record. Yeah, I've done some playing with Van Dyke, and it's just like, anytime that happens, I can't believe that I'm looking over at that guy.
He's amazing, Van Dyke Parks.
He is.
I like Discover America, too. It's pretty good.
I like that, too. And Orange Crate Art.
So anyhow, the great thing about working with Van Dyke was that he wrote the string quartet that we did on Small Town Spree. I think it's might be the high point of my recording career, I think, is when I played harmonica solo over the string quartet with Richard Green and people, with Van Dyke conducting, doing Small Town Spree. I still think it's one of the... greatest moments. If you want to hear it, it's on my blog at petercase.com. You go to the blog and the first thing on the very first blog story is about three different songs. And I think the second or third song has got a link to Small Town Spree. You can listen to it. The story's all written in over there.
Oh, cool.
But that was super exciting. Working with Van Dyke was great. And he did a great job on that.
Yeah, he's incredible, man. Nobody arranges strings like that guy.
Yeah, that's right. He's unbelievable. Yeah, I worked with him recently at the Bob Newirth tribute.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
Yeah, he was playing piano at that, and that was really fun.
Yeah.
Him and Mansfield and Fred Tackett and J.D. Doherty. Pretty heavy.
Yeah. What are another record or two of yours that are like throughout the, I mean, you've made so many records, but like throughout your career, as far as like being really memorable for you as the artist, that was like a special, you know, had special moments, or just like that you thought was your best artistically, which ones stick out to you as those ones?
I think the songs are really great on that one called Blue Guitar. And I did get to play with Rye Cooder on that record. That was really fun. David Hidalgo was on it. And
do you know Rye?
Yeah. I haven't seen him for quite a while. He's up down there in Santa Monica, you know? Yeah, I love Rye Cooder, man. He's the greatest.
Yeah, his son Joaquin plays drums for me.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
He's great, Joaquin. My friend, do you know Jesse DiNatale?
No.
Yeah, Rye is the greatest, you know? He's really great. And he was very nice to work with. And I like this record I have called Full Service No Waiting.
Oh, I don't really know that one.
I think that maybe it was the best one I did in the 90s.
Okay, I got to check that out.
It's my favorite. And a lot of people really like it. I know Peter Blackstock from No Depression really liked it. And
like song-wise, it's your favorite? Or was
it? Just everything about it. Like it was like, you know, you go and make records and you try to get the songs as together as you want. And then you go in and you hope, you know, you hope that it's going to come out in a way that like, you, they all come out different and you don't really know. But that one, I worked with this fellow named Andrew Williams, and we'd set up in a office room, like a wooden office room that was like being inside of a guitar or something, this old room over in Hollywood. And he just set up like an ADAT or something in there. And we had a drummer, Sandy Sheila, was playing on suitcases and stuff. Nobody had really done this at that point. So it's an acoustic record, but it's got this like lo-fi thing to it. And it doesn't seem like an acoustic record. It seems like an electric record.
Cool.
Electric acoustic record. And it's got this really interesting vibe to it. Greg Lease plays guitar on it. And there's a song on it called Spell of Wheels. It starts the record. And Greg just did this like really beautiful hypnotic slap steel thing on it. And yeah, it was just a really fun record to make. And we made it all there. And Andrew's a great producer and he sings with me on it. Like there's a lot of harmony on there, you know, just kind of rock and roll harmony and folk harmony. And the songs I wrote all in this one, I had this room that was like an office with like a portable typewriter in it. And I would just go in. I had kids at the time and my kids were, you know, took a lot of my time, but I would have like 4 hours every day. I would just go into this room and just go crazy typing lyrics, trying to write the, you know, And I, so I wrote this whole document of like, you know, 50 pages of like single spaced, you know, rhyming lyrics with the music playing in my head. I could hear it in my head while I was doing it. That was the weirdest record. And I wrote all the lyrics like that. And I would just be able to go pick up a guitar and play the song right away.
Wow, with those that's so songs. Cool.
Very weird record. So and the drummer was this kid that never really played in bands or anything. He played for choirs. His name's Sandy Sheila. And he could have been like the number one call in Los Angeles if he would have wanted to do that, but he wanted the front bands himself. And I don't know what he's doing right at this moment, but he's a great drummer. He just has a great, impeccable feel. And so it was great. It's a fun record. So that's on Vanguard. I think it's still in print. You can definitely still hear it on Spotify and all those kind of things.
I'll check that out. It's good to know the backstory to it.
Full Service, No Waiting. Yeah. That's one of the best ones. And then, I like the records I've just done recently in a row. I did Highway 62.
That's a great record. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I did that. And Ben Harper came down on that one and played a lot of lead guitar on that record. And Don Heffington, Heffington on that.
What made you think of Ben Harper to play guitar on your record? Like, that just seems like, I don't know. He just doesn't do that much.
No, he doesn't. You know, but I didn't really ask him to do it. He showed up.
Really?
Yeah, he's the greatest guy in the world, man. He's so nice. And he was just so generous. And we were both, he made a record in that same studio and he heard that I was recording. And he just came down and offered his services and he showed up for like the whole 2 weeks. He was there the whole time. And he just contributed that.
And does he play regular guitar? Was he playing Weisenborn or what was
he was playing a Weisenborn and he also played some electric.
Yeah.
It was a lot of Weisenborn and electric. And then he was just on hand, you know, for a lot of it. And so, it was really great. I've done he's in a movie. They made a movie about me a couple of years ago. It's like a documentary or something. And he's in that quite a bit playing guitar and talking and stuff.
Okay.
He's great, though. I know his mother has a studio out in a store.
Yeah.
You know about that?
I do, in Claremont. Yeah.
Yeah. Claremont Folk Music Center. And so I play there a lot. It's one of my favorite gigs.
Okay.
And
was the Harper family a family that you knew kind of like just being in LA and that store was a bit of a scene and stuff? Is that how you got to know them?
The store was definitely a bit of a scene, but I didn't realize that it took me a while to realize that Ben was part of that scene because he was out on the road all the time. Yeah. So I didn't really get to know him then. No, I didn't. It kind of came in sideways.
Okay. Because
the first time I ever worked with Ben was in the late 90s. I was producing the Mississippi John Hurt tribute record called Avalon Blues. It ended up being Grammy nominated.
Love that album.
And I produced that record. And then Ben played Sliding Delta on there.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, a really nice version of it. And so that's the first time I ever talked to him.
Oh, okay. So you didn't know him before then?
No.
Wow.
I asked him to do it because I knew at that point I did know about the Folk Music Center. And I knew that I had heard that he really knew a lot about John Hurt. So we got a hold of him.
Okay.
And so, I mean, he plays an incredible version of it on that thing. That record was so much fun. And then we got nominated for the Grammy and all that stuff and went down. And it was really exciting.
Yeah.
It was great making that record. It was fun.
How did that come about? Was that something that somebody approached you about putting together? Or was it your idea and you found a home for it? Or what was the genesis of it?
There's this kid named Kevin Welk, you know, that was coming up through the ranks over at Welk Music. Welk bought Vanguard and I was signed to Vanguard. And so the Welk family bought it. I'm like, oh my God, this is weird. But then this kid that had been working in the mailroom, Kevin, he becomes the president of the company, you know? And I'd known him ever since he started over there, you know, right after he got out of college, he was over there working for Vanguard before they were owned by the Welks. Or maybe right when they bought, I guess they were associated with, they were buying it, you know?
Yeah.
And then they took over and then they moved to a new location and everything. One day we were down there and there's a suitcase laying over there and I go, but yeah, anything, if you open up that suitcase over there, it's going to be an accordion. And they open it up and it's like an accordion. It says Welk on it. And I was right. And so I used to go out and eat tacos in L.A. with Kevin, you know, for kicks. And we went out one day and I'm going on.
So is he like Lawrence's grandkid or something?
Yeah, Lawrence is his dad. Well, no, he's his grandkid. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
His dad is Larry Welk.
Okay. Crazy.
So Larry's Lawrence's son. And so we're out eating tacos and I'm like, You guys got the whole Mississippi John Hurt catalog in your vault over there, you know? We should do it. And you guys said, you know, why don't we do a John Hurt tribute? You know, you got, I know I didn't say why didn't we? I said, well, you guys should do a John Hurt tribute record over there, man. And have some, you know, it was kind of a thing. The guy goes, that's a great idea. You produce it. You're it.
That was it.
That was it. That was it. And so I did it. It took a long time. It was hard to get everybody to cooperate and all that kind of thing.
I did a thing kind of not too unlike that. And it was like, it was a ton of work. Like I can imagine that, you know, that was.
What did you do?
I did a tribute to the Mississippi Sheiks.
Mm. Hey, I'd like to hear that.
I'll send you a copy.
Will you send me a copy of that? I'm a big fan of the Mississippi Sheiks. Wow. Who played on that one?
John Hammond's on it. Van Dyke Parks did a really crazy arrangement on it.
What song did he do?
He did Bootlegger's Blues.
Wow, that sounds like a great record. I got to get a copy of that.
North Mississippi All Stars are on it, and Bruce Colburn. I think Bruce Colburn's on your thing too, right?
Yeah, he is. He's great. I love Bruce Colburn.
Yeah. Anyway, like that one that I did, it was like an epic amount of work, and so yeah, I can imagine. I know what you must have gone through to put that all together.
Yeah, you probably know exactly what I went through. But the worst thing that I went through was I was trying to get Taj Mahal to be on it because I knew how much he loved John Hurt. He was like his bodyguard and guide back in like, you know, 67. So, and I had these old pictures and I really wanted to get Taj on there. And so I called, I didn't know how to get a hold of Taj. So I'd met him before, but I didn't know how to get a hold of him. So somebody told me who he was managed by Bill Graham Management. So I call over there, man, and I get this guy. Oh, yeah, that's very interesting. Tell me about the project. Tell me about the whole project. I go, well, this, that, and, you know, it's for Vanguard. The money's going to go to this, and then we're going to donate, you know, this, and then da-da-da-da-da-da. And who's going to be on it? Da-da-da-da-da-da. I go through this whole rap, you know, and he goes, very interesting. Okay, this sounds really great. I think there's something, Taju, you know, I'll get back to you about this. I don't hear anything. I don't hear anything for like weeks, months. And I'm doing the whole rest of the record. Now it's been a year and I've called the guy like several times and he's never returning my call. And then finally I get through to him over there after about 10 phone calls to the switchboard. He finally takes my call. I'm like, please, we're trying to rep, you know, please take my call. And he takes my call. He goes, so tell me about this project.
Oh my God.
And I'm trying to remember. I ran into somebody else. I'm trying to remember who it was. It wasn't Van Dyke. It was somebody. And he goes, God, I'm spacing out right now. It was somebody on the folk music scene. And they go, don't call that guy. Like, just call this number here. This is, I think it was the Larmans from the folk scene people.
Oh, yeah.
Just call this guy. He's Taj's road manager.
Right.
So I call that guy. And he's like, no problem. And so he gives me another number. And I call it up. And it's Taj, you know.
Yeah.
Taj goes, of course, man. Yeah. You know, he starts telling me all these stories about Mississippi Charter. And like they set it all up and then we had it. But it took like a year's worth of phone calls and all this other nonsense, you know.
Persistence, man. Good for you.
Yeah. So that was tough, you know.
Yeah.
Gillian Welch is on there. And
yeah, it's a great record.
Know, a lot of people. A lot of people I knew played John Hurt stuff. You know, when I met Bill Morrissey, we met in a hotel room in West Virginia, and we had a night off, and we just sat all night playing John Hurt songs hotel.
Yeah.
You know, so I knew he knew a lot of them. And
what about
Steve Earle? You know, I'd worked with him, and we'd both sat around and done the same thing at one point. So I think he's on there. I can't remember all who's on there. I knew Hyatt knew about it. So I got a lot of different, it was mostly people I knew. I don't know if that record's in print anymore. Is yours still in print?
Not really. Sort of. There's copies kicking around out there.
Who did that one? The Mississippi Sheiks one.
We put it out independently.
Oh, that's good. I don't even have the John Hurt record. I don't even know if I might have one copy.
I got one.
You do?
Yeah.
Never came out on vinyl. I wish they'd put it out on vinyl.
I know they should now. Yeah. And Beck's on there too, right?
Yeah. That was another one that was like a long,
I bet, layers of managers.
Yeah, that might have even been worse than the other one. But it came in, you know, came through by the end, you know.
So what's happening for you now? Like, are you going to tour this record and like do a piano tour, or is it just business as usual for you, or what's going to be the thing that you do when the record comes out?
Well, Steve, I think it's going to be business slightly unusual, but not completely unusual.
Okay.
And so I am going to carry a keyboard.
You are.
That sounds great, a Yamaha, and it sounds really good, but a lot of places have, about half the places have good pianos. You remember every every bar in the world used to have a piano like 20 years ago. Do you remember that? And they all unloaded them, man. Where did they all go? Like, even bars, you know, every nightclub, any place, that every recording studio, they all had pianos. Now they don't.
Yeah.
And so about half of them have pianos. So I'm going to carry a piano. I'm still going to play guitar at the shows. I'm going to play piano too. You know, I'm not crazy about it. It's like a module piano, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't look that great, but, you know, I don't know.
Totally. I know what you mean.
It's not as cool as an upright, but I don't know what to do about that. We'll just see how that all goes. I'm starting to have a slightly different feeling about touring and everything. Like, I just used to be like a road dog, and I've done so many gigs on the road. And then being home was very interesting over this pandemic, because this was the only record I've ever been able to write, learn how to play, and then record on one, you know, shot.
Without splitting. Yeah.
I think it adds a lot to the focus and the heart of the record.
Oh, cool.
I think you can hear there's kind of more of a kind of peace at the heart of this one.
Yeah.
It's not, maybe not, you know, focus, you know, that I can hear it. You know, I don't know if other people can, but, you know, I was always on the road, and it's always interrupts your life. And I'm thinking now, you know, I'm also into other things. I'm writing a book, and I'm also, you know, I do like visual art and stuff. And so I'm kind of, not that I'm that good at that, but I'm not trying to market myself as a painter or anything, but I like just being able to work on things. You know, people don't realize, like, when you're a touring musician, like, your whole job, really, like Jerry Jeff Walker, I did a gig with him one time, and he goes, the job, you know, you travel for a living and you play music at night to relax.
Totally.
That's totally it, man. You know, you travel for a living. Every day you're out there traveling, and it's just so time consuming.
Yeah,
you know,
it can be a total nightmare.
You know, I've seen the country over and over and over again, and I do enjoy traveling in America and meeting everybody and stuff, but the pandemic taught me, the shutdown taught me, the pandemic didn't really teach me anything, but the shutdown did teach me how valuable time is and how much of it is in a day that you can do so many different things. And touring is fantastic. And you get to go every night and do something creative in front of for people. And it's very beautiful. And I love doing that, but I'm not sure I'm going to do it to the same degree. Like, I'm kind of thinking I'm just going to maybe do the best shots.
Be a little more selective.
Maybe, you know, instead of just like beating the bushes and playing, like, you know, because I've just played every kind of gig. And like, I feel like at this point, maybe that's in the cards.
Yeah, well, that's cool.
I'm 69 years old in about another month, in about 2 weeks.
Right on. That's a good age.
I don't feel 69, but after I go on the road for, 10,000 miles, like, even when I was 30, I felt like I was 69. So it's like,
totally.
I remember Dave Alvin on the road, he'd be coming out of a van like, really feeling this one, Pete. That was a long time ago. You know, it's tough.
Yeah.
I love playing on the road, but, you know, I really do. I love performing, and you get really good when you perform every night, but there's, I don't know, I have to look at it. You know, it's not like I have like a huge support network on the road. Sometimes usually I go with one person, and it's, you know, it's difficult. So I don't know. It's very time consuming. Like Bob Dylan's on his bus, you know, and he's got all these people, and he's staying at, you know, 5-star hotels, and they roll up, you know, amps and pianos to his room and everything like that.
Yeah, it's a little different.
You know, he's wonderful, but, you know, and he knows people, you know, the royalty of the world, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I don't mind I love the people I see on the road, and I see my friends on the road, and I have a great time, but it's just so intense, you know. And it's not like at 69 I'm going to have like a bust out hit, you know, that's going to, he's got to go on the road.
You never know, man.
Get out, you know, it's like, you know, it might be a popular record, but it's not going to be like, you know, it happens when you're 30, you know, or 25.
Yeah.
A lot of my favorite music is people playing solo. I love the John Hurt solo records. I love Monk solo and the Monk solo records. I love the band records too. I love it all, but there really is something to that solo voice. Once you get into it, you know, the troubadour thing is very appealing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It grows on you, for sure. But when I was a kid, I had the first Bob Dylan record. I thought it was like the greatest rock and roll record I'd ever heard. And it's just completely solo. It's like Sun Sessions or something. That first record, he's just wailing with his voice.
It's punk rock, man.
It's good, yeah. It's really good. I mean, I'm kind of in this club too, but like, you know, I'm into free jazz. Like when I was a kid, I was into Cecil Taylor.
Yep.
At the same time, I was into Mississippi John Hurt.
Sure.
I had the record called Conquistador by Cecil Taylor. And I loved it. I used to play it. Only two tracks on the record, one on each side of the album. You just like, it was wild. And just waves of piano and saxophones, and, you know, just a great record. And Kelly Joe would say that Mississippi, we were talking about time, and he was talking about how Mississippi, Fred McDowell's time, it was like circular time, and that it would go up and then down. We were talking, so we had this long conversation about timing and about how it's similar to the free jazz people. So he says that it, you know, he's a pretty far out guy. You know, he talked about how he was into like the Portland free jazz scene.
You know, he's an amazing bass player.
Yeah, he was into that whole scene, and then he began to listen to Fred McDowell and those guys, and the other guy. Pete Williams, Robert Pete Williams. He was listening to that as it in the same kind of head that you would listen to a free jazz record in.
Yeah,
and we talked about that, and you know, it was pretty interesting, obvious in his playing. I mean, I thought he was great. You know,
yeah, we toured like I was in his band. Like when he stopped playing slide, he got me to play slide for him, which was terrifying and. It's kind of a terrible gig to have because like I loved his slide playing and I also wanted to hear him play slide, but he didn't want to do it anymore.
You know, why was that? He felt like he got hamstrung by it.
He did. And basically with him, it was like anytime anyone said they wanted him to do something, he just wanted to do the opposite. So the more people harassed him about like playing slide, the more he was just like, no way, man, that's a sideshow. Like, I'm not into it. And he just like stuck to his guns with that. But then he started playing slide again. But Bottleneck.
What do you mean bottleneck?
Like up, like he wasn't playing lap.
With the guitar up, not in the lap, but up. You start playing bottleneck.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
I hadn't seen him for years. The last time I saw him was in Boulder. We were doing E-Town together.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I did Mountain Stage with him one time too, but we hung out at E-Town.
Yeah.
We did some music together at that and talked a lot.
Yeah.
I don't really know what happened to him. I know he went to Canada. I hadn't seen him for years.
Wow. Well, great talking to you, man.
I hope to run into you in one of these places in the world.
Yeah, maybe we'll see you at a festival or something.
That'd be cool.
Yep.
You going out on the road and playing?
A little bit, yeah. I'm doing some Canadian dates in April and May, and then a few festivals and stuff over the summer.
Hey, what are you playing solo or with a group?
I'm playing with my band. I've got a three-piece band, so drummer, bass player, keyboard player.
This goes under your name?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll see you out there, man.
All right, man.
All right, good talking to you.
You too. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening, everybody. Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast is produced at the Hen House Studio in East Nashville, Tennessee. Please remember to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist for Spotify and Apple Music at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thank you again to our sponsors this season, Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra in 1964, the Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resonator Guitars, and the Hen House Hang. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. Over and out.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.